Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features General Gordon Baker Jr., the history of struggle in Detroit, Drum, and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wiza Muntali. The music in the background is Work Song by Cannibal Adderley Quintet. The show features General Baker from a 2010 talk he gave at the U.S. Social Forum held in Detroit, where he maps the history of struggle in Detroit, the formation of Black radical workers' movements, and the legacies of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. General Gordon Baker Jr. was one of the founding members of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, or DRUM, in 1968, and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in 1969. Baker's involvement in radical politics dates from the early 1960s. Here is African Owl's executive producer and co-host James Pope with the show.
I wanted to start our session with this rather prescient thought from Ingalls, something you will hear General Baker posit in the talk you will hear next. Ingalls, in June 1874, 3 years after the 1871 Paris Commune, argues in the program of the Blanquist fugitives from the Paris Commune that it is a simple-hearted childishness which quotes impatience as a convincing argument in support of a theory. Lenin, slightly repurposing this thought, argues in Left-Wing Communism, An Infantile Disorder, section titled No Compromise, that it is childish innocence to present one's own impatience as a theoretically convincing argument. It is no question that we are at a very important juncture globally. I do not think this revelation is as revelatory now as it has been at other world historical junctures. The thoughts presented at the outset add validity to this notion. However, it cannot be lost that the revolutionary role of the working class has more advanced potential than these previous epochs. Many are overwhelmed at the seemingly multiple areas of struggle. The common refrain from many is this: too much is happening at once. It's a lot. Let's be clear, this sense of quote overwhelm is part of the logic of oppression to separate and confuse the masses into privileging the seemingly novelty of the moment. What I mean here is simple. It is a historical fact that the objective material conditions at various moments of intensification of oppression produce simultaneous response from the masses. This spontaneity, through an intentional disassociation from the genealogy of both oppressive structures and historicity of mass response to them, often distorts the ability to understand the primary contradiction at the moment of conjunction. This is found in the often confused responses or underdeveloped answers to the questions, what are we resisting? Why are we resisting? And what new society are we attempting to build? The threat of quote history then presents its challenge to structures of authority, as a clear understanding of it always pushes us to be conscious of the continuum of praxis, captured in the simple complexity of seeking the answer to what are the historical examples that can provide clarity to what is to be done. It is here I posit that it is without doubt the League of Revolutionary Black Workers is one of our important examples to study, map, extract, and apply lessons learned. Let's see why. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers organized in the late 1960s in order to fight race and class oppression in the auto plants of Detroit, Michigan. They sought to address the objective material conditions within which they found themselves and developed a subjective social response to them, one that was intellectual, organizational, and expressly political. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers did this through a combination of theory and practice that resulted in the intellectual development of the members of the League and new organizational forms, as they created a pedagogy of revolution, or what Lenin called an education for revolutionary activity. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers was a workers' struggle, led by Black workers to achieve certain objectives at a particular moment in a particular space. However, the development and practice of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers is part of the long struggle in Detroit, specifically a struggle that developed at a major turning point of global capitalism. A turning point that meant the end of the rise of Detroit as the industrial center of the United States and the beginning of its decline within the context of global capitalism in the late 20th and 21st centuries. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers was formed as an umbrella organization that brought together various local struggles, known as the Revolutionary Union Movement, or RUM, in the automobile plants of Detroit and other workers' groups. Composed of Black workers, they adopted a Marxist orientation combined with a nascent and particular form of Black nationalism. Coming into existence in 1968 and lasting until about 1973, they were able to organize a vast number of workers and to fight for their collective interests. They did this through developing a pedagogy of revolution that was used to raise the critical consciousness, that is, class and revolutionary consciousness, and spread the idea of struggle to other workers. The struggle as developed by the League of Revolutionary Black Workers is captured in the historical reality of the political development of Black workers in the heart of global capitalism in the United States and within a leading sector of capitalist production in the early and mid-20th century. These socioeconomic conditions cultivated a section of Black workers into revolutionaries and comrades. Members of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers were shaped by this historical moment within which they found themselves. That is, the end of the post-World War II capitalist expansion and the beginning of capitalist globalization rooted in another iteration of advanced technological automation of the forces of production. This technological evolution in production also necessitated the need for a series of socio-cultural philosophies as justification for this evolution in capitalist extraction. As a result, the very process of their pedagogy of revolution, or the processes they developed as education for revolutionary activity, as evidenced in their study of theory and of their analysis, shaped their practice. Though based in local struggle in Detroit, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers always positioned themselves through their analysis in the bigger struggle against capitalism, imperialism, and racism, and saw their ultimate goal as the liberation of all oppressed peoples in the world. Muhammad Ahmed, in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, a historical study, argues that in order to understand fully the lessons of the League's formation to its dissolution, a proper contextualization should investigate the overall development of the Black movement in combination with understanding the concentration of industry in Detroit. More Black workers were hired in the auto plants between the end of World War II and 1960. The Black community, for a large part, relied on the Liberal Labor Coalition. There was adult Black labor leadership as well as prominent Black radicals in the community. Detroit's inner city was also the Midwestern center of Black nationalism, not to mention the Socialist Workers' Party had a strong base in Detroit. Their influence was evident in the Black community in the early 60s. Other various groups in Detroit, GOAL, our Group on Advanced Leadership, led by Richard and Milton Henry, also known as Imari Obadeli and Gadi Obadeli, founders of the Republic of New Africa, was representative of adult involvement in the movement. GOAL was a Black nationalist group where Reverend Albert Cleed was considered GOAL's ideological leader. James and Grace Lee Boggs, who split with the Facing Reality group of CLR James, played an instrumental role in providing a synthesis between Black nationalism and socialism. But the most important influence was Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz. In fact, three of Malcolm's most influential speeches, Message to the Grassroots, The Ballad of the Bullet, and his February 14, 1965 talk at the Ford Auditorium in Detroit were at GOAL-sponsored events. Imari Obadeli dedicated his 1966 pamphlet, War in America, The Malcolm X Doctrine, to the Malcolmites. And an early draft of the RNA's New African Creed staked its authority by the grace of Malcolm. These linkages provide young Black radicals with a rich Black radical leadership as a resource base. The Boggs were important to young Black radicals because they had a wealth of information, constantly wrote and published a newsletter called Correspondence, helped organize the Grassroots Conference in 1963 and the Freedom Now Party in 1964. Discussion sessions were held at the Boggs Home, which provided young Black radicals with insight and concepts, goals, strategy, and tactics of socialism. Early in 1963, Black students at Wayne State University formed a revolutionary Black nationalist socialist action cadre called YUHURU. YUHURU was more militant in goal, Reverend Cleve, and the Boggs, but maintained a close relationship with them. YUHURU was led by Luke Tripp, John Williams, John Watson, Charles Johnson, General Baker, and Gwen Kemp. YUHURU members studied Marx, Lenin, Mao, Fanon, Malcolm X, Robert F. Williams, Che, and many others. They attended Socialist Workers' Party's weekly forums, listened to members of the Communist Party, and followers of C.L.R. James. In 1964, when Grace Boggs and Reverend Albert Lee were instrumental in developing a strong statewide Freedom Now Party, some members of YUHURU were organizers for it. Also in 1964, YUHURU members went to Cuba where they met Robert F. Williams, Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and Abdul-Rahman Mohamed Babu. Some joined the Revolutionary Action Movement, and in 1965, they regrouped to form the Afro-American Student Movement, which put out a theoretical journal called Black Vanguard, edited by John Watson. Black Vanguard was distributed to Black workers in the plants, but was considered, quote, too theoretical and thick for a positive workers' response. In 1965, Glanton Dowdell came to the cadre. Dowdell's street experience added valuable skills to the cadre. In 1966, Dowdell, Baker, and Rufus Griffin helped form the Black Panther Party in Detroit. A mini rebellion broke out on the East Side, and the three were picked up by the police and charged with carrying concealed weapons. Baker and Dowdell were convicted and placed on 5 years probation. Early in 1967, Dowdell was given a suspended sentence. During the winter months of that year, Ram organized the Black Guards and Self-Defense Community militias in Detroit. Join the Black Guards slogans were on walls all over Detroit. On July 22, 1967, the largest Black insurrection in the history of the United States raged as thousands took the streets and fought the police, National Guard, and the U.S. Army for 5 days. Dowdell and Baker were picked up on July 24th. The Detroit Rebellion raised the national consciousness of Black workers. On May 2, 1968, a walkout of 4,000 workers occurred at a Hamtramck assembly plant, which stemmed from a gradual speed-up of the production line. Production soared from 49 units to 68 units an hour within this short period of a week. The mobility of the worker was slowed to the extent that it was difficult to keep pace. As a result of the walkout, picket lines were set up around the gates and individual workers began to amass. This situation occurred on the afternoon shift and carried over to the first shift. During the initial picketing, the company sent out photographers to photograph some of the picketers. These pictures were used as evidence against some of the picketers and were instrumental in discharge and disciplining certain workers who took part in the walkout and picketing. Chuck Wooten, one of the 9 workers who founded DRUM, describes how DRUM came into being. During the Wildcat strike of May 1968, upon coming to work, there were picket lines established, manned by all white workers at the time, and as a result of this, the Black workers received the harshest disciplinary actions. A few workers and I went across the street and sat in a bar. It was here that we decided that we would do something about organizing Black workers to fight the racial discrimination inside the plants and the overall oppression of Black workers. And this was the beginning of DRUM. The example set by DRUM inspired Black workers in other plants to establish DRUM-type organizations at their factories. Black workers would attend DRUM meetings to learn the techniques of organizing and to discuss the situation at the plants all across the state, from which Black workers would come to help in launching chapters of DRUM. The strike at the Hamtramck plant called by DRUM stimulated the creation of FRUM, Ford Revolutionary Union Movement, and LRUM, Eldon Avenue Revolutionary Union Movement. An important factor in the League's development is the fact that it came into existence as the reaction to the spontaneous self-organizing of Black workers. The national consciousness of Black workers was at a high point as a result of the July 1967 rebellion. This carried over into the plants, where young Black workers were more determined than ever to do something about the inhumane working conditions. Though Drum, in its formative stages, was an in-plant study and action group, the May 3rd, 1968 Wildcat strike was the catalyst that made Drum into a valuable in-plant black workers organization. Organization and structure didn't come into existence until 2 months after Drum's development. Reacting to the spontaneous actions of the workers proved to be a contradiction that was never fully resolved within the league. Sustaining activity in the interests of workers became major problems for the in-plant organizers of the league. However, the concept of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers had been in the minds of activists General Baker, John Watson, John Williams, and Luke Tripp for years. In 1964 and 65, they had put out a theoretical journal called Black Vanguard, which called for a League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Between December 1968 and spring of 1969, meetings were held with the Cadre Collective, a loose coalition of activists who had worked together since the days of Yoruba, to discuss the formation of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. The contradictions which later emerged within the League were prevalent from its inception. A major aspect of these contradictions occurred between in-plant organizers, or workers, community activists, and petty bourgeois intellectuals. As Muhammad Ahmed wrote in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, a historical study, whether one disagrees either partially or substantially with the politics of these organizations or individuals is quite beside the point. What should historical information and revolutionary values to a fresh generation of Detroit activists? And I would extend to generations beyond Detroit. Today, we will listen to General Baker from the 2010 talk he gave at the U.S. Social Forum held in Detroit, where he maps the history of struggle in Detroit, the formation of radical workers' movements, and the legacies of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Born in Detroit, Michigan on September 6, 1941, right after his family had moved north from Augusta, Georgia, General Baker's father worked for Mittman Steel in the 1940s, and later in a job with Chrysler. The Baker family settled in a home in southwest Detroit. General Baker grew up in a union household and often attended union events with his father. Baker graduated early from the nominally integrated Southwestern High School in 1958. General Baker is one of the founding members of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, DRUM, in 1968 and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in 1969. Baker's involvement in radical politics dates from the early 1960s. He had been a member of Uhuru and the Revolutionary Action Movement and later the Communist League. Following the Detroit Riot of July 1967, an event known to some as the Great Rebellion, General Baker and his fellow radicals sensed an opportunity for new organizing efforts. In September 1967, Baker, John Watson, Mike Hamlin, and Luke Tripp started a newspaper called The Inner City Voice. The paper focused on issues of concern to Detroit's black population, including working conditions, housing, healthcare, welfare programs, and schools, all from a Marxist perspective. In addition to publishing The Inner City Voice, Baker, Hamlin, and other Inner City Voice staff members formed a study group to discuss how to implement revolutionary political change. On May 2, 1968, in response to a work speed-up at the Dodge main plant, Baker led workers out of the plant in a wildcat strike. On May 5, the Chrysler Corporation dismissed Baker from his job for violating the no-strike clause of the collective bargaining agreement between Chrysler and the United Auto Workers, UAW. As a result of this strike, Baker and his fellow activists formed DRUM. DRUM saw both Chrysler and the UAW as enemies of workers of African descent, and from 1968 into the early 70s, DRUM worked to gain more power for African-American workers and to improve working conditions at Dodge, Maine. General Baker is and will continue to be one of our important sociopolitical and cultural theoreticians of the 20th century that provided essential perspectives for the 21st century. As part of the collective of revolutionary workers who sought to organize the black working class in conjunction with addressing issues in the larger black community, General Baker was a living example of theory and practice in the context of black liberation globally. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities in Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi. Brazil, the Avila Village in Detroit. Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Listen intently, think critically, act accordingly. I feel so good when you're by my side. Check my Johnny Depp playing the role of a fly guy, whatever. I thought together we're tougher than leather and never fall for the pleasure under pressure, but it seems all that glitters is gold. Well, good evening.
Yeah. Good evening,
General. What a pleasure. I first want to thank you all for this golden opportunity. I don't feel like I deserve all of y'all.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real pleasure to be able to talk about the history of struggle and the task that we got in front of us. You know, and it's really touching for me because, you know, coming through some of the struggles we came through in the past, I didn't think I lived long enough to be explaining some of this to people and sharing those experiences. So I really want to thank you in that regard. Well, let me say, like I was saying last night, I'm homegrown. I was born here in Detroit. My parents were sharecroppers from Georgia. They came following Ford's cry for 5 hours a day in the auto plants in 1941. I spent my life working in these auto shops. You know, I spent 40 years in the auto plants. I got hired in 1963, and I retired in 2003. But it took me those 40 years to get 30 years seniority because I got fired so many damn times and transferred and switched and changed names so many times, you know, that I couldn't get the 30 years credit for the 40 I did. Okay, so the experience we share ain't legal experiences, you know. They're experience that we got through struggle properly. Let's see, let me tell you, secondly, that even though I'm a retired auto worker, I'm married. Marion Kramer is my wife. We got 7 kids, you know, and 6 grandchildren. So we're not struggling for a nation of ghosts.
Yes.
We think that if we're going to win this struggle, we got to have some people here to help carry it through. She's downstairs in the plenary today, and she's a little bit angry at me because I'm up here, she down there. but that's the way it's there. Let me say this, that... some of my experience, I mean, Detroit is an auto town. And when we say that, we mean that in a real way. There was at one point the Chrysler Corporation alone had 29 plants in the greater Detroit area. GM had another 15, Ford had another 10, and they had other kind of parts suppliers too. In 1966, Chrysler Corporation had 66,000 employees in Detroit. It was the largest employer in the city of Detroit. Now Chrysler Corporation ain't got but almost 20,000 employees nationwide. So you see how much it's failed. But back in those days, you know, when you grew up in this city, it was a booming town. You know, the auto industry came in the early 1900s. Matter of fact, at the turn of the century, Detroit led the nation in building iron stoves. You know, in 1901, 1902, iron stoves was the main product being built here in the city. And you know, the iron stove is a stove you use wood to cook in. So you show you how rapid things change. So the auto industry, as we know it, is a little more than just 100 years old. It's not much more than that. And we probably, you know, when the auto industry came in this city, you know, the horseless carriage paved the way with Henry Ford and his discussions on the moving assembly line that actually changed things. So this city grew and grew and grew based on the demand for labor in the auto industry. At one point, when Ford decided to pay $5 a day, which wasn't really true. I mean, that's the story that's out there about $5 a day. But you had to fit in a real special category to get that $5. You know what I mean? Everybody didn't get the $5, and the $5 didn't last that long. But just to cry for $5 a week, when people were making $5 a day, when people were making $6 a week, you know, it was quite an improvement in life. And that's what draw people from foreign lands, from Appalachia, from the Deep South, all over. People poured into Detroit, you know, looking for work. In that situation, the auto industry began to collapse early. You know, we had the cyclical crisis of production going up and then falling down because it overproduced. By the time we got to the Great Depression, you know, in 1929, most of the auto plants were shut down.
And you really talk about the organizational history of this working class in this city developing after, during and after the Depression. It was in 1932 we had what's been called the historic hunger march in the city of Detroit. And that's, it was during that Depression, you know, that these unemployed councils developed all over the city. And they were basically ethnic based, because you had every ethnic configuration that you could think of. Henry Ford was a specialist in making sure that all the people he had had ethnic breakdowns so they couldn't communicate with one another, and therefore he could keep union drives out of there. And those are the conditions that he fought for and he built. What happened in a lot of, in the course of that was these ethnic movements developed unemployed councils based on neighborhoods. And the unemployed councils got so strong about in 1932 and 33, where the unemployment in Detroit got to be about 50%, that they began to fight the evictions. So they were putting people back in their homes, and they were doing that with a frenzy. I don't know the brother not here that was on the front page of the PT that was being evicted out of Toledo. Did you see the People's Tribune with the guy, with the guys with the jack boots, evicting him out of his house? You know, and they dressed up like stormtroopers. You know what I mean? But anyway, those kind of conditions exist in that period of time, and these unemployed councils developed to try to put people back in. We had a couple of situations that developed in which these unemployed councils decided that they had to take this fight for hunger against the automobile manufacturers. And so they decided that they go after Ford Motor Company, because General Motors had a lot of numerous plants, and so did Chrysler. But Ford had one big major facility out in River Rouge. By that time, the transfer had been made from Highland Park to River Rouge. At that River Rouge plant, at that time, they hired, had about 80,000 employees at that one plant. So they decided that they would march on Ford demanding jobs so they could eat. So these tens of thousands of unemployed people, you know, in these unemployed movements marched all over the city. We had a pretty progressive mayor of the city at that time named Frank Murphy. So what he did when the unemployed councils marched through the streets of Detroit, he gave them police escort because he knew they was going to Dearborn. So these unemployed movements merged, and they went to got to Dearborn with a crowd probably about 10,000, because the unemployed councils from the suburbs met them on Miller Road in Dearborn. There they were stopped by the Dearborn police, told them they couldn't go any further. The unemployed councils had a democratic decision to go ahead and march on. As they marched up Miller Road, first they were hit with fire hoses by the Dearborn Fire Department that watered them down. This was on March 11th in 1932, so it was really cold in Detroit on those days. They marched further, and the Dearborn police sent horses after them and started stomping them. And by the time they got to the gate four, they opened up with machine gun fire. And five workers were shot and killed, and another 25 or so were wounded. And the hunger march stopped. What happened, what grew out of this was the largest mass funeral ever held in this city, where 65,000 piled into downtown Detroit, you know, and participated in the funeral procession for these four. It was five killed, but one died later who was black. So the four, they had a funeral for the four, and the black guy was, they cremated him and spread his ashes over the roof plant, because they couldn't bury him in the same cemetery where the white guys that was killed, because we had the segregated cemeteries at that period. I mean, anger that grew out of this massacre that took place at Ford Motor Company. Now, you got to understand, ain't nobody ever been brought to trial or charged with nothing. And Ford, they never been held accountable, you know, for this murder on the streets. You know, but out of this mass drive became the seeds for organized labor to try to organize the shops in the city. When Roosevelt was elected and the Wagner Act was passed, these same activists out of the unemployed councils, they were communists and socialists of that day, took that struggle to organizing the shops. And they first had the big success at General Motors in Flint in 37, when they went in and had the sit-down strike at Flint. And after a long 60-some days with sit-in, they were victorious in getting a union contract at General Motors. Once that happened, the sit-down movement broke out spontaneously now. And the way history reads is sometimes that organized labor organized these people, but that's not the way history plays it. These developments became spontaneous. People sat down themselves and called the union, said, come organize. So the union didn't do it. I mean, the women at the dime stores and millinaries and restaurants all over town sat down and started calling the CIO, come over here and sign us up. You know, so you see these movements break out spontaneously. You know, they are not organized. They are not conspiracies. People take it up on themselves to take up the challenge to be a victory. And that's the way that thing developed. And most of the auto industry was organized at that period of time, except Ford Motor Company.
You listened to a portion of a talk given by General Baker from a 2010 talk he gave at the U.S. Social Forum held in Detroit, where he maps the history of struggle in Detroit, the formation of radical workers' movements, and the legacies of the League of the Revolutionary Black Workers. General Gordon Baker Jr. was one of the founding members of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, known by its acronym as DRUM, in 1968, and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in 1969. The music in the background is All the Way from Africa by Keturah. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
Ford Motor Company had a different history. When they attempted to organize Ford Motor Company with the same tactics that they used at GM and Chrysler, they were soundly defeated, and that's what's called the Battle of the Overpass. And that's when Walter Reuther and those other leaders of the union were beaten by those thugs that Henry Ford had hired, and it beat back the organizing drive. Now, the main reason that they could not organize Ford, because Ford Motor Company had hired almost 17,000 African-American workers in that Ford Rouge plant. And because of the particular conditions they were confronted with, they had a particular solid loyalty to Henry Ford. They didn't give a damn about a union. And most of the unions at that time still had discriminatory clauses. And they had no reason to try to trust a union over Henry Ford. Henry Ford, when he hired them in, not only confined them to the foundries, but he had blacks appointed to stamping plants and assembly plants. He had upgraded them throughout the industry, so it was a real solid loyalty, you know, to Henry Ford. And therefore, they had to back up and regroup and recognize how to deal with this dynamic, you know, that they confronted with here in the Rouge plant. What happened was that they finally developed an organizing committee for the black community. They made decisions to bring Paul Robeson into Detroit. John L. Lewis flew up with the coal miners, and the coal miners took up the task of organizing the Ford Rouge plant. I guess John L. Lewis and them took the dues of the coal miners to organize the auto workers, and I thought that was a gracious statement in his part. You know, when you gotta tell your membership, look, we can't advance 1 ounce unless we organize this other section. So we got to take our dues and do that. With this effort of bringing John L. Lewis and having these huge rallies at the Olympia Stadium and organizing the progressive black preachers in this, Reverend Charles Hill and a few other ones, and had them actually preaching at the factory gates, that they finally was able to break this thing and organize Ford in 1941. And so once that broke through, you had the big militant local out of Local 600 that ended up being the best local that we ever had. That local understood what solidarity meant. Rest of the locals didn't. That local understood what discrimination would get you. The rest of the locals didn't. So we had that one big progressive local that developed, and it's still that way today. Almost all the black leaders in the UAW that rise up come out of Local 600 because it's different. In 1941, things changed rapidly. Most of you know this stuff, and I'm just going to repeat it to you. But, you know, the war broke out Ford was organized in April of 41. Pearl Harbor Day was December of 41. Once Pearl Harbor Day came, there wasn't a single new car built between 1941 and 1945. I know you all know that. And please don't go out looking for a 1942 something another, because it don't exist. The entire auto industry was transformed into war production. Mm-hmm. The government covered the cost of production plus 10%. So the companies didn't care how many people they hired, because they were going to be covered by the government cost. In the process of this, Detroit became one massive sea of humanity. People came from everywhere. Streetcars ran all night and all day. All the plants ran 24/7. Massive amounts of production. The Ford Willow Run plant was built in Willow Run and hired 42,000 people. That's why we saw Rosa the Riveter out there riveting airplanes together. We ran PT boats at the plant that I worked in. Armaments and tanks were made all over the city. So that actually changed the whole character of production, but it became a sea of humanity in this city. So that's kind of the important history early on of the development of the industry and organization of labor in this country. We had all kind of conflicts in the midst of the war. The stories I tell from the old guy, had an old guy, Dave Moore, I used to run with. He passed away last year. He was 97 years old, just articulate. And he was telling me about how during the war, when they were building all these trucks, the Teamster unions would not allow blacks to drive these trucks. They had army trucks parked up all over Livernois, all over these streets, and white workers was killing themselves trying to drive all these trucks to the army bases. So these blacks appealed to try to figure out a way for them to break through, had all kind of resistance from the Teamsters. They had to end up appealing to Eleanor Roosevelt to get them to break the discrimination and allow them to drive those trucks and get them to the army bases, else they'd have been stuck there behind some discrimination. The other part that we had was during the middle of the war, we had these racial riots that broke out in Detroit. When black workers first entered the Packard plant in assembly positions, all the whites walked out. Same thing had happened at Temple Axe. So you had this strife that existed on the plants where blacks were supposed to stay in janitorial jobs or foundries and were not supposed to integrate into final assemblies. They had a housing project that they built here. It was a government project named the Sojournal Truth Projects that originally was built for the black population that was expanding as people poured into the city. And when it actually got built, they said, blacks can't have it now. We're going to give it to whites. All kind of conflicts broke out over that. But then this rebellion spilled over in the street in 43. Those riots lasted for about 3 or 4 days in the midst of World War II, where we should have been fighting Hitler. Troops had to be brought back home to stop the racial unrest in 43. The same thing happened in Mobile, Alabama. I don't know if anybody from that area that's here today, but in Mobile, it was even worse than that because they were building those big ships in the shipbuilding industry. When blacks first went in there to do welding, whites walked off or jumped them and refused to let them do it. So, you know, you had those kind of conflicts that developed. But things got better and went on. To show you the solidarity that existed at this Rouge plant, I had this other guy run a Quill Petway, and he's worked in a tool and die plant, which was a building that had mainly Anglo-American workers. And he said that during the riots, he was missing for 4 days. He couldn't go to work. And when he went back to work the next day, when he walked in the plant, all the white workers were cheering the fact that he was still alive. So he shows you the kind of solidarity that developed in that one shot that meant so much, to them. So those are the struggles that developed early on throughout the war years. And those struggles continue. But they're important for you to know because at that period in history, over half of the factory workers, over half of the black factory workers that lived in Detroit worked for Henry Ford. Which was a tremendous surprise. But I think that background I'm telling you is how Detroit became a black city. That all those factory workers, that was not the intent of Henry Ford. He was hiring them all to keep them from building a union and uniting with the rest of the white workers. But the, The end results of that ended up building a huge black middle class in the city that grew up on the basis of that. And I think it's important for you to know in terms of understanding how the city got the way it did. It wasn't accidental. Wasn't nothing magic about it. Hell, Henry Ford was trying to keep workers from organizing, and he got the different results from what he angled for. You know, so those are the early struggles that we had in the city. Meanwhile, Detroit prospered. We had the largest amount of single home dwellings of any city in the country. Detroit is a city of 139 square miles. And we had all of these single homes, not a lot of apartment buildings or brownstones. Everybody had single homes. I used to work in the factory. I had factory workers with were so proud of their homes, they carry pictures of their houses in their wallets. Mm. You know, ain't that something? I'm so glad this mine.
Yeah,
that kind of pride, in the fact that they got to be homeowners.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the background to a lot of those struggles in that period. By the time we get to the mid-1950s now, after the war, then we see the plants begin to diminish. Matter of fact, anybody drove a Packard lately? Anybody seen when the Packard car, you drive down the street of Packard? Well, listen, over on the east side here in the city, we got the Packard plant still sitting there. Last Packard rolled off the line in 1953. And the raggedy factory still sitting over there on the boulevard in Mount Elliott like a big old soul. They done tore down all kind of stuff since then. And they gonna put it on us, right? Like, this part of the old blighted old neighborhood. Hell, we didn't do nothing. We didn't have nothing to do with no Packard. You know, Packard left, Studebaker closed. You know, Kaiser and Frazier went out of business. You know, I mean, all of those places, those old cars you used to know that were made here, they all split, so those were gone. And we ended up having, at that time, the Big Four, because we had Chrysler, Ford, GM, and American Motors. You forgot about that one, too. American Motors used to make the Nash, you know, and the little Henry J, you know, and they made the Jeeps. Okay, so we had the Big Four then. Was another one I missed?
The Rambler.
Okay. So that's the kind of production stuff that we had here in the city. But these plants began to break up in the 50s and move. They started moving to suburban areas because they were afraid of union organizing. Coming out of World War II, after the war, there was a whole wave of strikes because during the war we had no strike clauses. The workers couldn't strike because striking would affect the war production. So as soon as the war was over, workers started striking everything, and the soldiers came home. And that's what set the groundswell for the passage of the Taft Riley Act, you know, that ended up leading to the right to work states in the South and all that in 1947. So by the time you get to 53, they start breaking up the plants, start building suburban plants, sending the plants, you know, other places to try to minimize union power inside those plants. So that's what we went through in the 50s. And ever since then, in the 50s, we've been in a crisis in this city with overproduction, you know, and companies moving and leaving. Some started to go south. Others just closed altogether. And the city began to change. By the 1960s now, that's when I was able to get a job. 1958 was probably one of the worst years in the auto industry. That's when the Edsel was produced by Ford, which was the worst car ever produced in the auto industry. The massive Edsel came out. And I don't know if they sold 5 or 10 or 15 of them cars. It was the worst one that ever came out. And but it kind of marked the point where most of the auto industry laid off everybody. And people didn't get picked back up until about 1962. After the Kennedy election and the early beginnings of the outbreak of the Vietnam War, then auto production began to pick up. I got a job in 1963. I don't know how much culture you stay up on, but what was it, the Stylistics? One of those singing groups had a tune out in the late 50s called Get a Job. Get a Job. Because you couldn't get one. So they had a tune called Get a Job. Matter of fact, it was about 1963 when Smokey Robinson and them answered it after they start hiring, he said, I got a job.
Yeah.
Finally got a job. You know. So the cultural movement kind of followed, you know, the economic movement in the city. Well, you know, when I got a job in 1963, I got a job. We were making the front ends and back ends for the Mustang. You know, the new Mustang came out in 1964, and it sold for $1,500 brand new. $1,500 brand new. And that's when Wilson Pickett broke out with his song, Mustang Sally.
Yeah.
Because it was ruled as a woman's car, this new Mustang. So the 60s saw the development of work inside the shops expanding. Matter of fact, when I hired in it, I hired in the Ford in 1963, but I didn't last long. You know, I lasted about 9 months and got fired. So I had to go to Dodge Man to get a job. See, back then, jobs were so plentiful. You could work day shift here, get fired or quit, and go over here and work afternoons at the next plant. You could just pick your way. It was simply that easy. So when I hired in at the Dodge Main plant in 1964, they hired a whole shift at once. So 5,000 of us went in there together. The Dodge Main plant had 10,000 employees. They put a whole second shift on, hiring 5,000 people at a time. So I'm just trying to give you a sense of how massive hiring was and how lucrative things was at that period of time. I know Alonzo over there back hiding. He went in the plants back there too. but anyway, that was the kind of the mood of the city during that period of time. What happened was that obviously the rest of these plants hadn't changed. We had all kind of discrimination inside the shop. You got hired when I got hired at Dodge Main. I go in with a white buddy of mine. I end up in the foundry, and he end up my foreman. You know, or I end up, you know, in spot welding and body shop, and he end up in skilled trades. You know, discrimination was just that tough. You know, you couldn't get the kind of positions that was held open mainly for blacks at a lot of these Chrysler and GM plants was real discriminatory, and that's what set the basis for us begin organizing inside the shops. We began to do organizing work inside the factories after the rebellion, but I talked a little bit about that last night on the plenary, you know, during the rebellion in 1967, when Detroit exploded like that. First of all, I just want to say it's a real joy to stand here today and see all you young people. It just makes your heart lift and think that we got hope we can win this struggle. Well, let me tell you, I'm homegrown. I was born here in Detroit in September the 6th, 1941, at the old St. Alban Hospital. Dr. Ossian Sweet delivered me, slapped me on my butt when I came out of my mama's womb. So he not only gave me my birthright, but passed on a legacy of struggle, and I tried to live to carry that out the rest of the days of my life. Let me just say this, the Detroit Rebellion in 1967 is a defining moment in this city's history. I at that time, was working at the Dodge Main plant. We were working 12 hours, 7 days a week. I didn't get off work on the afternoon shift to 3 a.m. in the morning. And everybody that got off with me went to various blind pigs all over the city. It was part of our life. You work afternoon shift, get off and go to the blind pig because the bar is closed, and that became part of your daily activity. So when the rebellion broke out in about 6 o'clock that morning on 12th Street in Claremont, I was right there, Johnny, on the spot. I was living 3 blocks from there on Gladstone. After the police came and tried to raid the blind pig, and it was surrounded by about 100 workers on the street that started throwing bricks at the police, then people broke down the street and went to the pawn shops first. Now, you got to understand a thing about that almost everybody back then lived off the pawn shop. You work and get paid on Friday, go buy you some stuff, and by Wednesday the next week, you had to put it in the pawn shop to have enough to eat the next 2 days. And if you ever pawned anything, you know, on the back of your pawn slip, it says in great big letters, not responsible for fire, theft, or other unavoidable accidents. So everybody, the first people that went into the pawn shops had to go in there to try to get their own stuff back. Obviously, they took somebody else's when they was in there. I was arrested on the first night for violation of curfew and did 15 days in Ionia State Penitentiary waiting to come back to trial. It's a lot of characteristics of the Detroit Rebellion that was different than other rebellions. First of all, everybody proclaims that the Detroit Rebellion was integrated. The first person killed in the Detroit Rebellion was a white worker that was looting a store down on Trump. When they carried me to Ionia, I had two white guys on my bus that was arrested for sniping. Secondly, the Detroit Rebellion is the only one that had an assassination that took place during the course of the rebellion, and that's the Algiers incident, the Algiers Motel incident that no longer exists. First thing they did was rename it to the Desert Inn, and that lasted a few years, and now it closed it, and when you get to Virginia Park and Woodward, it's a gated community with a brick wall there, and the Algiers Motel have been wiped off the pages of history.
You just been listening to a portion of a talk from 2010 by General Baker at the U.S. Social Forum held in Detroit, where he maps the history of struggle in Detroit, the formation of radical workers' movements, and the legacies of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. General Gordon Baker Jr. was one of the founding members of the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, known by its acronym as DRUM, in 1968, and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in 1969. Baker's involvement in radical politics dates from the early 1960s. He had been a member of Uhuru and the Revolutionary Action Movement, known by its acronym as RAM, and later the Communist League. General Baker was part of the collective of revolutionary workers who sought to organize the black working class in conjunction with addressing issues in the larger black community. General Baker was a living example of theory and practice in context of black liberation globally. The full discussion will be on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Gwenembe by the MBC Band. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muizam Tali. Up next is Headline News, which is followed by Shah Anana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, which is followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, and that's followed by Human Rights and Justice with Akichi Taifa, and that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Kombitla Kai with Eugenia Charles looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now executive producer and co-host James Pope, and thanks to our engineers Michael Nasella and Claire Chapman, and thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdersen, and thanks to the entire team here at WPFW, and thank you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Tres Empoli by Franco and TP OK Jazz, remembering the legendary musician Franco Luambo Magadi's birthday, which is July 6th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
Pona ninyo salaka bongo bongo Okolo balikambo yo tala simate Okolo balikambo yo banga batote Pona ninyo salaka très impudique O okokota na ndako ya bato oyoka soni te mpona nini osalaka bongo ye ozalaka na yo trese poli ye.
Born in 1899, Edward Kennedy Ellington ranks as the greatest all-around musical figure. This Thursday, July 11th, from midnight until midnight, WPFW honors Ellington on the occasion of his 125th birth year with Ellington 125, a celebration beyond category. Hi, this is Miyuki. WPFW must move, so we will be raising funds toward that end. Our goal is $15,000, and there are Ellington 125 commemorative gifts available as a thank you gift for your support. You can donate now or anytime on our website. For those that contribute to our relocation fund and are able to donate $125 or more, a special commemorative 125 Ellington thank you gift is described on our website. Help WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bengert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Unionized workers at South Korea's Samsung Electronics announced an indefinite strike today, extending an earlier three-day strike announced on Monday. The union is demanding higher pay and better benefits and has accused Samsung management of refusing to bargain. In a statement, the union said it engaged in disruptions of Samsung production lines and it is, quote, confident of our victory. Samsung said there had been no disruption to production. Last month, some Samsung workers used annual leave in a one-day walkout that appeared to be the first labor strike at Samsung. Over 30,000 workers belong to the National Samsung Electronic Union, just a fraction of the 120,000 Samsung workers in South Korea and the over 250,000 globally. The Israeli military ordered the full evacuation of Gaza City today, pushing ahead with a renewed offensive in the city that has killed dozens of people over the past 2 days. The heightened offensive comes as U.S., Egyptian, and Qatari mediators are meeting with Israeli officials in Qatar today. Hamas warned that the Israeli operation in Gaza City could cause ceasefire talks to collapse, despite apparent recent progress in negotiations. Gaza City had been the focus of Israeli operations early in the nine-month war, but militants appear to have regrouped there after an earlier Israeli withdrawal. The official death toll in Gaza is over 38,000 people, but a new study from the Lancet Medical Journal estimates that as many as 186,000 deaths could be attributable to the war in Gaza, including indirect deaths caused by food and water shortages and disease. The report estimates that about 10,000 dead bodies are still buried in rubble. In domestic news, late yesterday, a seventh elected Democrat called on President Biden to stand down as the party's candidate in the November election, following a day of closed-door meetings. New Jersey Rep. Mickey Sherrill said Biden should step aside because in an election against Trump, quote, the stakes are too high and the threat is too real to stay silent. Biden and his aides have been pushing hard to convince Democrats to back the president following his disastrous debate performance last month. Biden has refused to step aside, and in a letter to lawmakers earlier this week, he said he still believes he is the candidate best suited to beat Trump in November. Yesterday's meetings between lawmakers were closed door, but anonymous sources and multiple media outlets said many lawmakers continue to express doubts about Biden's ability to lead the party and to win the November election. Two Democratic senators announced yesterday that they are seeking a criminal investigation of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas over gifts of travel, a loan for a recreational vehicle, and other benefits he received from billionaire Harlan Crow and other wealthy benefactors. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a member of the Judiciary Committee, and Senator Ron Wyden, chair of the Senate Finance Committee, released a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland citing, quote, evidence of repeated and willful omission of gifts and income. While it is unclear if Garland will actually grant White House and Wyden's request, the letter reflects an escalation in efforts by Democratic senators to address ethics controversies related to Thomas and the court in recent years.